American film director, screenwriter, and producer, best known for Academy Award-winning collaboration with Quentin Tarantino, screenplay Pulp Fiction, and more, has just blown people away with his expose on the satanic death cult. And from my research, he's dead on. You are. He's joining us when a bunch of stations join us in about 5 minutes. Here's part of John Bowne's latest report. We'll come back with Roger Avery. Stay with us.
It was unheard of for a sitting American president
to file a lawsuit against a news outlet. This never happened before until President Trump returned to office for a second term. But now he has sued the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and as of this morning, the BBC.
President Trump, domestic propaganda has been the bane of your existence.
Obama repealed the 1948 Smith-Mundt Act, which then permitted propaganda to be in broadcasting. It no longer said that it had to be credible.
Inevitably, Obama's Orwellian Smith-Mundt Modernization Act will be amended or repealed. We are going on nearly 15 years of its implementation, and mainstream media has become nothing short of an enemy of the people. But you knew that. Case in point, in the heart of New York City, outside the opulent Gracie Mansion, American patriots led by J6 prisoner Jake Lang gathered to sound the alarm on the creeping Islamic influence under Mayor Zohran Mamdani's regime.
An explosive device with bolts and screws was thrown into a crowd. It happened in New York City on Saturday during a protest that turned violent outside the mayor's official residence.
New York City got extremely lucky yesterday. TATP is enormously volatile. It is not very stable. It's extremely powerful. And it is the footprint, and if you go by past events, of serious bombing attacks. The London 7-7 attacks, Richard Reid's attempt on a plane. Many of us remember the Ariana Grande attacks outside the Manchester Arena. These are situations where you're well into double figures of people killed, never mind injured.
Instead of condemning the barbaric attack, Mayor Mamdani, a self-proclaimed progressive Muslim template, doubled down on vilifying Lang as a white supremacist.
This was a vile protest rooted in white supremacy entitled Stop the Islamic Takeover of New York City. I'm the first Muslim mayor of our city. Anti-Muslim bigotry is nothing new to me, nor is it anything new for the 1 million or so Muslim New Yorkers who know this city as our home.
The mainstream media echo chamber followed suit, amplifying smears against American patriots and populism.
Authorities say they were part of a group of nearly 125 people counter-protesting a much smaller anti-Islam demonstration led by Jake Lang.
The violent
pardoned U.S. Capitol insurrectionist who has frequently sought out political confrontations in the months after President Trump gave him clemency. In a statement, Mayor Zohran Mamdani is saying, quote, yesterday, white supremacist Jake Lang organized a protest outside Gracie Mansion rooted in bigotry and racism.
Obama's CIA media monstrosity uses many tools in their propaganda toolbox. One of those is called minimized framing, where certain aspects of a story, event, or issue are deliberately downplayed, underemphasized, or minimized in the framing process. This allows acts of terror, sedition, or treason to carry on toward their goal. CNN recently illustrated minimized framing in stark detail, posting about two jihadist terrorists as if their innocent lives took an unexpected turn on a lovely warm day in New York City. CNN had to redact and apologize. Another tool is outright lying.
Two Republicans say Muslims don't belong here after an attempted terror attack against New York's mayor, Zohran Mamdani, and the House Speaker, Mike Johnson, says nothing really to condemn those comments. I incorrectly said that the bombs that were thrown by ISIS-inspired suspects in New York over the weekend were directed
right, we're
at Mayor
break.
Mamdani.
Look, propaganda, there's government, there's corporate, you name it. But the good news is, because of X and a few independent places, we can challenge this now. They definitely want to clash with civilizations. Our huge guest, Roger Avery, straight ahead. You don't want to miss this. Share the live feeds now. We'll be right back.
I've been an OFO for as long as I've been an InfoWarrior, 18 years.
and Texan, born and raised, so I know, like, knives, like you do. And I finally broke down and ordered one. I got the neon orange, and I'm blown away. I've had Benchmark knives that are easily $400. Had them for a year, lost them. This thing has the same feel, same quality, same, I mean, everything about it. I haven't had a knife stay this sharp in a long time, and I'm, like, horrible with equipment. I'm, like, very abusive with knives at work every day. I'm extremely impressed. I'm very impressed. So anybody out there listening, who knows if there's a knife comes back in stock, get one. You know, any of them. I want to get the Ring knife when it comes back out. Other than that, I'll join all the supplements and,
Yeah, particularly the pocket knives, the folding knives, the flip knives are super high quality at incredibly low prices. I mean, these same knives sell in stores all day for like $80 or selling for like $40. We'll be right back.
Discover trends and global developments years before they happen right here on The Alex Jones Show.
Roger Avery with us. As you know, I don't like much of Hollywood. They don't make really anything that good, in my opinion, compared to what they used to, because they just are churning it out, but not Roger Avery. I mean, when I start going over the list of films, like, that's one of my favorites. 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 Pulp Fiction, Beowulf, the list goes on and on. His writing is amazing because, at an instinctive level, it connects with us. And so he's with us for about an hour and a half. We're very blessed to have him. And he said some really great topics. Recent movies is predictive programming, for example, Civil War and Leave the World Behind. The Obamas helped produce that. Iranians attacking Los Angeles, or is it part of a larger PSYOP? AI filmmaking, Ignorance is Bliss, films about forgiveness, the rights return or attempt to return to Hollywood in an effort to regain the lost soft power. And we're going to just talk about a bunch of other subjects with him. So, Roger, I was really captivated, and I love Joe, good friends with him, but to be captivated by your interview, I never watched his interviews twice. I watched it twice over a couple of days working out, because I just wanted to, because everything you said was, I knew was accurate, but also it taught me a lot of things. And I wanted to ask you to talk about yourself, your journey, how you discovered that this Satanism really is a underpinning of so much of what's going on, where you think it's going, kind of your 35,000 foot view, and then you've got the floor to go through these topics, starting with predictive programming. But again, thank you so much for being here with us. Find you on X at Avery, A-V-A-R-Y, and Avery.com. So Roger Avery, thank you so much.
Thank you. First of all, you really summarized everything that's on my mind right now and that I'm thinking about and that I'm noticing, not just in Hollywood, but in the world in general. And secondly, I want to tell you that when people found out that I was coming on your show, I suddenly started receiving calls like, don't do it. Be cautious. You're going to get blackballed or whatever. That actually made me want to go on it more.
By the way, did this start only 2 hours ago? Because I was writing the show headline and almost didn't put Roger Avery in it, because a lot of times guests don't come on because I announce right away, but then they get a bunch of calls.
Yeah. I got the usual calls from the usual cast of characters, you know, people trying to calm the narrative, I guess. And but, you know, I've been a fan of yours for a really long time. I mean, to be honest, I've been a fan of yours since I think it was Waking Life that you were in. And I was like, who is that guy? And then when I started researching you and discovering you and then watching you over the years and realizing this guy, you know, speaks his mind. He speaks the truth as he sees it, the testimony of his eyes. And you take arrows like crazy. and you've remained steadfast. And I look at you as, I mean, somebody I think in your last segment said, you know, that you're the canary. What they mean is you're the canary in the coal mine. You're the guy on the, you know, in the trenches on the front lines, you know, speaking your beliefs. And there you go. I love this scene. And actually, I'm a big Linkletter fan.
So, I am too.
I mean, Linkletter, I'm glad to hear that. I didn't know what your relationship was like with him after all these years and everything. But, you know, I think Rick is, of all the filmmakers out there right now of my generation, I think he's the best. I think he's the best of us and that he represents the best of us. I think he takes the greatest risks of any of us.
There's a dirty side of Hollywood. He's the opposite. Just baseball, America, apple pie, a true classic liberal, just a classy, just totally real guy.
Well, you know, it's crazy because we're right now in the Academy season and or the award season, I guess, as you might call it. And I think the Academy Awards are Sunday. I never watched the Academy Awards. In fact, I resigned from the Academy a couple of years back. And I one thing I did notice was of all these movies that are listed, and I think there's some, you know, interesting movies made this year, more so than recent years past. But I noticed that one movie was missing, glaringly missing for me, and that was his film Nouvelle Vague. And I don't know if you've seen it, but it's about the making of Breathless. And I think this is hands down, without question, absolutely the best movie of the year. And completely ignored by the Academy. But then we have to ask ourselves, what is the Academy? Like, what is this organization? And it's a and what are these awards? And what was the original purpose of these awards? And I mean, you know, I entered this industry very naive and loving movies and believing in movies. And I look at the cinema experience as a kind of near sacred congregation. You know, you sit in a dark theater. You're sitting next to someone you don't even know, who is maybe completely different than you. You know, the different race, creed, religion, like everything is different about them. And yet you're sitting there next to this person in the dark, and you're both sharing this kind of ecstatic waking dream, looking at little stained glass windows projected on the screen. And
we know humans are psychically connected. Princeton's now measured it with devices. So it's really a communal psychic experience.
Yeah, it's a congregational experience. And I think it takes us back to church and even before church, you know, back to the campfire where we're just sitting in the dark of night, telling each other stories of our myths and traditions, just trying to get through the night. And so there's this really important quality about being next to someone, a real person, again, someone you don't know, and sharing this kind of invisible bodily electricity together as you share this waking dream. And
it's an incredible communion. It's an incredible communion.
It's an incredible communion, and it's a really important aspect of our culture. And I really believe that there are dark forces that kind of wish to separate
that's what the lockdowns were about. I mean, they wanted to make us depressed and isolated.
Yeah, divide us up, lock us up into a room. You're a slave to some subscription service, and you're watching things alone, and then they can control the programming individually to you. And over the years, I've kind of watched as movies have transformed and changed, and maybe it's a function of my becoming older and seeing the world more, because when I was young, as I said, I was naive when I entered into this business. I almost approached it like a surrealist. You know, I came in just believing that movies were about creative expression. I always knew that there was a certain amount of, I think we can call it corporate propaganda because it's show business, but there was usually an equal part of personal propaganda. And you would have filmmakers, you know, putting their messages about humanism and about culture.
So it was a trade-off. You know, you knew what you were doing, but it was still a trade-off.
There was something of a balance. And also the corporations, you knew that they were just a slave to money. They just want to make money. That's the business part of it. You know, the show part was usually something else. And just over the years, I feel like honestly, because the technologies have changed, the medium itself has transformed. We've gone from film, which is an absolutely separate medium from digital projection or digital filmmaking. And I'm not saying one is, I'm not trying to create an argument where one is better than the other necessarily. I'm just saying they are different. There is different as oil paint and watercolor paint, you know, oil and water, completely separate. And yet they're both paint. Except,
well,
you know,
one is so, to dumb it down, one is so disposable because it's so quick and there's so much of it. Just going back to film, because I was involved, like you were before me, literally 3/4-inch tape, very precious, with film, 35mm, didn't have any money, could only shoot it one time, had to get it right. Yeah. And so there was something magic about that it was limited to capture this. It made it so much more powerful. Now with digital, you can do it over and over again, and you'd think that would make them do more takes. They're right. Not pouring their soul into
cut.
It.
They don't even cut in between takes. Because, you know, the video you just run, well, first of all, you know, directors now, they'll delete takes like they're deleting an email. Like there's no real respect for the moment. We used to say, I'll see you in the moment. And what the moment was after all this intense preparation on set and getting everything just right, and the actors are off in their trailer or if in a room somewhere, you know, running their lines in their head and getting ready. There was all this like excitement built up. And then you would get there in front, and then you start hearing the camera running, and you know that you're spending like 4 cents every frame, and as it's whipping through the camera, and you know that you're burning money in that moment. And in that moment, you suddenly pop into another reality, and you perform. And
because it's do or die. I mean, I've not been involved in film like you
have it.
But let me take Linkletter. When we did Waking Life and the computers were crashing later and they had trouble, you know, doing it rotoscope back then. It's so easy now. But I remember later they called me down when they were actually going to pick the scenes because he said, just say whatever you want. And the first take, he goes, that's so good. I usually do at least 3 takes because it was stream. He goes, do it one more time. And then they sat there in between all their being busy 6 months later. He calls me and he goes, I want you to sit here and, you know, look at this. Which one do you think? Because we spent days watching these 2 takes. We think it's this one, but what do you think? And I said, yeah, it's obviously that one. But they still spent days just deciding, even though they already knew the first take, which was stream of consciousness unedited, was the one. They still spent 2 days watching it, and it totally changed.
Well, you know, it's funny. The people look at Waking Life and you think, oh, it's just computer graphics and it's like a filter, but it's not. That movie was, you know, the Rotoshop process was developed by a guy named Bob Savastan, who was probably sitting there with you at that time. With
I remember
Rick.
He was there. He was actually there. Yeah.
And they Tommy would Pallotta. Hand paint. It's all the hand of man is over every single frame of that. And I think that, you know, people we're as filmmakers, we're constantly trying to capture dreams. On because a movie is like being able to look inside of someone else's mind and to see their dreams. When I watch a movie by Kubrick, I'm watching Kubrick's dreams on screen. And with this movie, he captured dreams better than most. And many have tried. You know, Polanski does dreams very, very well, but Waking Life in particular, I think, was just such an amazing experience of and such an experimental film. And right now you're showing A Scanner Darkly, which was his other movie done like this, which, I mean, I just think Linkletter through the years, you know, with what was the movie Boyhood and where, you know, he's shooting it over long periods of time. He's doing stunts in movies that we just, you know, you dream about doing these kind of things as a filmmaker. And he is consistently doing it. Whether he succeeds or fails, you know, at the box office, because, you know, sometimes your movies don't work with a general audience at first. You know, he's always trying these amazing stunts. And this film that he's recently done, Nouvelle Vague, which is about the French New Wave of filmmakers. What I loved about it is that it was completely disconnected from any of the politics of our time right now or of any of the our current issues. And it is a movie that is purely about cinema and what it means to become a filmmaker and the evolution of Godard as he was becoming a director and the, you know, how everybody views you as you're doing it and the kind of approach you take to, you know, toward making a movie.
And so they're just examining a topic instead of trying to make it political.
He's not making it political at all. I mean, there may be some kind of politics in the movie, but what he's doing is he's really analyzing the French New Wave filmmakers and putting it all into context. And I learned things. I mean, I've studied, I've worked in France. I've made two films in France. I'm friends with all sorts of French filmmakers. I've read about the French New Wave, and I'm watching the movie and just seeing how he put the whole thing into context. I think it's one of the best movies about movie making that I've ever seen. And for it to be completely just, you know, brushed aside by the Academy and not considered just reminds me of what a joke the Academy Awards are.
Would you say it's because he's not a toady and not part of Hollywood and just lives out in Bastrop at his ranch?
I mean, that might be part of it. It's difficult to say because he's also made movies that are, like School of Rock. That may have been a very personal film for him, but it's also a very audience accessible, movie that's for...
Or Days of Confused was about him growing up in Texas. It's personal, but everybody likes it.
Yeah, and so he has this innate ability that and he sometimes makes movies like, what was it called? Was it called Flags of Your Fathers? I'm trying to remember. Okay, this movie almost has no cinema in it. You know, like, it's just him literally shooting because he knows he's mature enough to know when to step back, when to not let his ego get in the way of the movie itself. He in many ways serves the artistic statement that he's making, and he's had enough success.
I agree. Rick is so humble, and it's not fake. It's like he's like Obi-Wan Kenobi. He's like a servant.
Yeah, and I only know him like lightly. I've only met him a few times, but I admire him more than anyone of my generation right now. I think he's the guy when you look at his body of work and you look at the statements that he's made about humanity and who we are as a culture, like, he's a really important filmmaker. He's maybe the most important American filmmaker there is from my perspective.
Well, Roger Avery,
and I think this movie that he's made is as important to cinema. It's like it's almost as if Godard were making a dramatic movie about the making of his movie while he was making the movie. And Rick went out and my understanding is that they shot it on 16 just in Paris, with everybody in costume and everything. But, Paris is modern now and you've got dozens of cars in the background, and that they just kind of used digital lightly to change the background to make Paris, to make it look like how it used to look. And he absolutely captures one. I mean, as I was watching the movie, my wife, I'm not sure she enjoyed it as much as I did, but she was watching it. She was like, I don't know if I can enjoy this because I feel like I've lived this. Like, I watched you go through that exact same process. And so for anybody wanting to learn about movies, the history of cinema, the what it means to be a director and the what you have to go through to make a film, this is the movie. And so, I mean, I love it partly because I'm a filmmaker and, it's of interest to me. So maybe it's not going to connect
so
with
the reality of it. Is
but I can't believe that the Academy, would ignore this movie as they have, and to show other films which are, successful movies, like, for example, Sinners. I can understand why that movie made money and, why a general audience really ate it up. But I look at it and I'm like, okay, well, that's like From Dusk Till Dawn. It's like From Dusk Till Dawn. I don't really see it being too much different from that film. I prefer From Dusk Till Dawn because I like Robert Rodriguez as a filmmaker. But it just looks like a repeat to me. And so for this movie to garner like all the nominations that it's garnered, I'm like, what's really going on here? And then we just have to remind ourselves, what is the Academy Awards? Why did they start the Academy Awards? And the reason is because they, around this time of the year, you want to get a little bit more juice out of your box office and you want to kind of, punch the gas a little. And so you remind everybody and you say, oh, this is the best film. And then, it makes a little bit more money.
So it's purely exploitive instead of making it about the art form that made it popular to begin with. We got 4 minutes to break.
It has nothing to do with best picture. That that's a ludicrous term to make for that awards show to make. I mean, even look, I won an Academy Award for Pulp Fiction, and I personally, you know, love Pulp Fiction. But when you look at the other movies that we were up against at that time, I mean, Forrest Gump and the Kieślowski film, and I mean, Ed Wood, these other movies were extraordinary. I mean, I personally think Ed Wood was my favorite film of that year. Again, it's another movie about movie making. And in black and white, maybe this is a thing.
But I think you were too close to your creation. Pulp Fiction was totally new and also exposed a lot of undercurrent that was real and just really hit people. Like nothing ever been made like that. So it was truly avant-garde.
Well, you know, it's funny because one of the things that it was the structure of the movie was one of the reasons people were considering it so avant-garde in the moment and so timely. A lot of it is Quentin's execution of the film and how he approached the material, because the actual structure, you know, when you look at, I mentioned Kieślowski before, he had done a film called Three Colors, you know, Red, White, and Blue, with Juliette Binoche, and Julie Delpy was in white, and then Irene Jacob was in red. And these movies are doing the same thing. They're three separate films where you can see in the background the other films taking place. They're all taking place at the same time. There are three movies about one movie. There was also the Jim Jarmusch movie Mystery Train, which came out at that time, which these are all like happening right at the same moment. Mystery Train, you know, it's three stories that take place in this hotel, and you can hear this gunshot going off that you can use to synchronize the time within those three stories. And so it was kind of like, you know, an idea whose time had come. And what really makes Pulp Fiction, I think, special was, you know, I mean, Quentin's voice as a director, you know, he brought a very populist approach to the film, and he is, you know, he as a film viewer and as a filmmaker, he always goes for what is proven. I think he studies films and he figures out what is proven. What does the audience love? What does he love? And then he executes it. And some people say that's copying, but you know what it really is when you're a young filmmaker, you look to your parent filmmakers, you look to your cinematic forefathers.
Well, civilization is building on what was best and innovating and making even better. That's what it is.
Yeah, well, like, you know, when you're a child, you look to your parents and then you copy and you learn how to be. And then at a certain point, you kind of learn how to walk on your own. And, you know, with Pulp Fiction, he's looking to his cinematic forefathers. He's looking to, I mean, at that time, De Palma, Scorsese, like there's a whole group of them that are like Quentin's parents. And that are, you know, and there's, from my perspective as a filmmaker and somebody who worked on Pulp Fiction, there's a bunch of filmmakers that I look to who were my parents. I mean, that shot right there of Bing Rames walking across the street, that's from Psycho. That's taken directly from Psycho. He's walking across the street. He looks into the car. He sees, like, you know, that happens in Psycho. And I wrote it because I like that scene in Psycho.
Amazing. So, Roger Avery, stay there. I want to come back and get into current predictive programming, all the Satanism stuff on Joe Rogan. Incredible. It's amazing to have you. Listen to you all day. This is riveting radio.
My pleasure.
TV. Wow. And you can find him online at Avery.com and at Avery on X. I'm Alex Jones, back in a few minutes. So, CIA declassified documents last week, Operation Artichoke, to poison vaccines, food supply, and the water to dumb us down and make us controllable. Now new documents about ESP control, how we're really electrochemical systems, liquid crystals, and the pineal gland, and how most people have microscopic to actual large worm infestations, not just from cats, you name it, like Kennedy has one in his brain, and they didn't tell the public most cancer, breast cancer, brain cancer is worms. Now, this is all over the place. Joe Rogan talks about it. I have for years. But here it is. Scientists and doctors figuring out now, the CIA knew in 62, that dewormers could reverse most cancers and didn't tell the public that's mass murder. Here it is.
My parasite medications work against cancer cells. And it turns out that the parasites use mitochondrial substrate level phosphorylation in the tissue. And these fenbendazole kill these parasites. So I tried it on the cancer cell, And sure as hell, it targets the mitochondrial substrate and glycolysis. So we have a mechanism now why parasite medications are working. But cancer is not a parasite. All these people say, oh, cancer is a parasite. It's not a parasite. Parasites and tumors use a common metabolic pathway, and a drug that works against parasites can be very effective against cancer. And that's what we begin to see, especially under nutritional ketosis.
So to be clear, the anti-parasite drugs cut off the same mechanism in cancer, but we now know and have known that a lot of cancers from parasites, it's double good. And I don't sell that, but you can buy it online. And my medical doctor told me years ago, take this once a year as a regimen. I do. That's important information you might want to write down, folks, okay? All right. Ladies and gentlemen, you can look it up. Go to the UN Zone website. They admit it. Over 2 million people have cognitive disabilities because they do not have enough iodine. In the 20s, they found this house where to put in the salt. IQs went up about 20 points on average, 15, 20 points. Well, we have the very best atomic iodine in the world. Has been available in several years, ladies and gentlemen. But we have the original X2 back, but even stronger. Pure atomic. Atomic isn't radioactive. It means it's on the periodic table. It is absolutely pure. And I mix that with ultramethylene blue that is also on record good for your pineal gland and reversing the calcification, the rest of it. Your Doc Chambers on, medical doctor, special forces colonel, army colonel. And I said, what do you think methylene blue? He goes, oh, I've been on this since 2004, but I got blown up in Iraq. I had brain damage because it blew away the sheath that's on my nerves. So I did research and found out that they had studies going back over 100 years on methylene blue helping regrow the sheaths on your nerves and all the rest of it. Well, we've got the best methylene blue, and I just mixed the iodine with the methylene blue with this water. I'm going to drink this, and this is pure rocket fuel. So good for your body. Essential iodine with methylene blue together is amazing. Pretty scary looking, too. So, by the way, the new product is supposed to be available right now at theallshowstore.com is T3. It's X2 back even better at theallshowstore.com. So for all the fans that wanted it, everybody that wanted to get it, we have had it for over a year. It is back, reborn, like the Phoenix, even stronger. Exclusively available through our sponsor, theallshowstore.com. But regardless, our methylene blue, our iodine is the best, and it does so many other things. Libido, stamina, energy. It skips the oxidation process in the cells. The methylene blue and iodine works very similarly, and they go together like a horse and carriage. Get them both now. There's also another big sale as well at thealexshowstore.com, and I thank you for your support.
Lines of the information war. It's Alex Jones.
That's the amazing sound score from Beowulf that this guy made. What a great animated film. I love it. Roger Avery is our guest, ladies and gentlemen. And there we are. We are Beowulf. That's from years ago. And Roger Avery reposted. So he's here with us. I got so much to talk to him about here, and I want to get into predictive programming and movies and you know, all of it, the stuff he wants to get into. But obviously, I was already a fan of yours, followed your work, didn't know you were aware of my show and liked it. And then I see you on Joe Rogan, and I kind of watch it, listen in the car and here and there. And I said, I got to just get on the treadmill and watch the whole thing. And I did, lost probably 5 pounds doing it. But just amazing, because everything you were saying, I mean, I knew it was accurate and almost no one else is saying it, but then I wanted you to be able to go on with more about how you knew it. So back to what I said at the start of the interview, and we went off into Linklater, which was great in real filmmaking.
But, yeah, sorry about that.
But no, it was great. No, I'm glad we did it because I've experienced it, you know, lived it. So it's my own experience. You kind of answered, you said, you know, early on, you were just approaching it from your own perspective, hadn't been in the deep end yet, but how did you learn about predictive programming? How did you learn about the Satanism? How did you, and then now you're on the biggest show in the world, Joe Rogan, talking about it. I mean, that was a big move. I mean, or maybe you talked about it before. What's the process there?
Well, I mean, several things happened. A lot of it is a lot of these. I mean, there were a number of WikiLeaks dumps that that occurred, and one of them was about Sony Pictures. And I started investigating and reading all of the documents that were suddenly available, and it was like suddenly I realized, oh, like why didn't anybody tell me that's what the film industry is? And I it was one of those things I always kind of I think I understood like. You know, one can think of Hollywood as being the propaganda wing of our government. But something happened over the course of, and it was probably during the Biden presidency, where I started, looking around and I started, realizing that there was this kind of echo chamber in Hollywood. And I just definitely was not part of that. And then this most recent revelation with all of the Epstein papers coming out, and I started reading those as well. And then with what happened with COVID, and I had been working on a script about this virologist in Manitoba, in Winnipeg. And I was writing a screenplay about her, and she's a Chinese virologist who was the person who had developed the inoculations for leprosy. And it was a huge success, big, huge success. You know, Chinese company is manufacturing all that stuff in California. And I was writing a story kind of about, what it's like to be a rock star, and you have a hit, and then you're looking for your next hit. And I started noticing that, and there was all these articles that have since been, somewhat suppressed. I think it was in the Winnipeg Free Press, or City Press, and where she had been caught by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police shipping various copyrighted viruses, like Hanta and all of them,
which, by the way, appeared to be souped up versions.
Yeah, souped up versions, and they were shipping them directly from Winnipeg to Wuhan on Air Canada freight. And then the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, there's all the, they have to, everything's published, but they've redacted who her financier was. And when I started doing the research on it, I realized, well, it's one of three people, and those guys are the obvious people who you would think. And then suddenly I started realizing this is really nefarious. And then when COVID hit and they left the Kowloon Bridge open on purpose, during Chinese New Year when this was happening, just kind of allowing everybody to flow out. And all the stuff that was happening during that time, it was like, this is intentional. This is, the first time it's happenstance, the second time it's coincidence, the third time it's enemy attack. And I started realizing, oh, we're under enemy attack. And then the way our own local California government was behaving at that time, how they were, quarantining people on army bases, but then allowing people to go in and out of those quarantine areas. It was almost like no one is that stupid. That was her. And so I was writing a script about her. And so I started realizing no one is that stupid. This is intentional. We're intentionally doing this. And then everything just kind of, and look at this ridiculousness that we went through as a culture. And this was so, it hammered on us and damaged us so badly. And then I started realizing, because I'm a movie guy, that, that there were clues. There was the Soderbergh movie that had come out, Contagion, where basically they are talking about is it cautionary? Are they cautioning us that this is going to happen, or are they preparing us that it's going to happen through revelation of the method?
And then the documents come out that it was psychological warfare run by the defense ministries, Canada, the U.S., the U.K., to scare us to create this new civilization, to train us for carbon lockdowns in the future. So you, like many others, were already somewhat away. But COVID and all of it, with what you already knew, was so obvious, and now it's confirmed, that pushed you over the edge. And they thought Disease X and all their Rockefeller documents going back 30 years would bring in their world government. Instead, they now admit at Davos, it's destroyed them, it's discredited them, no one believes anything they say now.
Yeah, and thank God. I mean, this was an attack on the people. And I'm one of those people. And so when I, you know, when I kind of realized this and what was going on, and then I started looking around and, you know, all my friends and everybody, they're all just happily getting shots, you know, and now they're just dying left and right. And so when this started happening, I started forming a much heavier distrust of authority. And then I started thinking about it. I started looking at various movies and seeing the patterns and how it happened. And I think the one that I mentioned on Joe Rogan was Fight Club, made by, you know, a guy who's a commercial director. They hired a guy who makes commercials to make a big commercial that is effectively selling what's going to happen. And the movie itself is a manifesto. You know, it's a manifesto about bringing down the financial system, and, you know, the buildings all collapse. And when you look at what happened 1 year after Fight Club came out, it was 9/11. And then you start looking at, well, who produced Fight Club? And that was Arnon Milchan. And Arnon has openly admitted, this is not me saying it, this is him saying it, that, you know, he's a Mossad guy. He's a Mossad agent. And an arms dealer. That's what Fincher used to call him, was, my movie was produced by an arms dealer, like jokingly. And so then I start looking at Arnon Milchan's other movies. And he did this movie called Medusa Touch with George C. Scott. I think Lee Remick is in it. And in that movie, again, airplanes are crashing into buildings. And I think I mentioned on Joe Rogan that at one point very early in my career, I had been through John Milius, brought in on a little DOD weekend where we were all going to get together, and they got a bunch of writers together, and they put us in a little tiny ballroom type thing in Long Beach. And we all wrote scenarios for how to attack Los Angeles under the guise of if we come up with ideas on how to attack Los Angeles, we can come up with preventions for it, which sounds good to me. But again, I was young and naive at that time. And as I look back on that, I realize how nefarious that was. And now,
by the way, because I remember articles 20 years ago that even came out, I'm kind of jumping the gun, I don't know this is what you say you're saying, where it turned out they were telling top writers, maybe it had been you they're talking about, at these DOD-funded camps where you thought you were fighting terror, that they were actually going to use that for scenarios for training and or false flags.
That's exactly what it was. And so I was, when I started putting all this together in my head and realizing what a useful idiot I had been, throughout much of my career.
They got a top writer, one of the best in the world, for free, writing them scripts for stuff they want to either psychologically say or do.
Yeah, effectively for free. And so that was kind of like a third eye opened up in my head, and I started realizing all of this. And this was also at a time where I started approaching my faith in a much deeper way, and my belief in God in a much deeper way. Like, there it is, 9/11. So this is the revelation of the method, where
2 years before, they did it on The Simpsons and everywhere.
And people ask how I
predicted it. It was a lot of things in the media saying Bin Laden's going to hit us and all this. I knew the FBI had helped bomb the World Trade Center in 92. I interviewed Ahmad Salam. So I had all this data. But then I started having nightmares of the towers on fire being blown up. And it was the collective unconscious. It wasn't that my unconscious was more powerful than my conscious. So I just said, they're going to blow the World Trade Center. They're going to blame Bin Laden. They're going to fly planes into it. And I didn't even know that right around the time I was doing that, because I didn't watch a lot of TV, they had a lone gunman X-Files reboot where the government hijacks a jumbo jet, a small group, to fly to the World Trade Center to go to war in the Middle East in Afghanistan. And then I got a few years later contacted by Chris Carter, by some of the people on the show, never met him in person, but talked to email on the phone. And they said, listen, the CIA came to us at parties and said, sometimes you ought to do a story on this. So instead of Chris Carter writing a story for them, they came and gave him the idea. And people, when I talked about it, said, that's a lie. They talked to Carter and he goes, no, Alex Jones is a good guy. He's not a racist like they say. This is like 2016. He goes, and that did happen. So again, how crazy is that?
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, you know, it seems like a lot of people, when you get to a certain level, you start having a handler. You start having a CIA handler, and I got to know mine. And he's a pretty nice guy.
Wow, tell me about this. Whoa. Tell us about this.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you about this and other things. I mean, you know, once you befriend the people of power, let's say, and you start getting on people's radar, at a certain point, it's like, you know what? It doesn't cost anything. Let's put somebody on Avery and let's watch him. And just make sure that, you know, Avery is, you know, remaining in his predefined frame and not deviating too far from it. There's a group of guys, actually, and, you know, to begin with. And, you know, you get to know these people. And, you know, for a while, I was paranoid about it, but then I kind of got used to it. And I realized that, you know, just I don't know if I'm still on any list, but or need to be watched. Probably, you know, more recently, you know, I am. But I get calls from him every now and then, you know, advising me on stuff. And saying, hey, you might not want to talk about this. Why not talk about this instead? And you know, and stuff like that. And
well, I remember former NSA and CIA. What was his name? Michael Hayden, in a speech like 10 years ago, goes, we don't spy on bad people. We spy on interesting people.
Yeah, well, and they told me at one point, look, don't try to lose us because frequently your surveillance will be there to protect you. You know, and he gave me a scenario where this had happened once where some guy got jumped by a gang and they had to move in to protect their, you know, because they're surveilling
somebody. No, I had the CIA try that with me. They're like, hey, your wife's cheating on you. Here's the hotel. And I'm just like, and I go there and it's happening. I'm like, God, they're like, we want to help you. Now, see how the surveillance is good?
But you know, told that story.
Oh God, I'm out of control, folks. But this is how it works. Because like, we're here to serve you. We're here to serve you. Yeah.
And it's all part of soft power control. You know, I got invited to this dinner that was being thrown by a bunch of like the Palantir guys, and you know, I go to this, meal in a private club and in a private room, big private room with a banquet table. And, you know, there's all the people you would imagine would be there. Oh, like there's the Top Gun guys and, oh, you know, there's so-and-so and there's this director. And I was thinking, why am I here? And basically they got up and they made a very good speech, which was, what happened to, and it was actually Shyam Sankar, the CTO of Palantir, got up and basically made a plea, what happened to the American cinematic universe? And he wrote an essay about this called The American Cinematic Universe. What happened to The Hunt for Red October, you know, Die Hard, these movies that were supportive, you know, one could say of, you know, Die Hard supportive of law enforcement, even though it kind of makes fun of the FBI and even though it's making fun of like kind of the goofiness of the LAPD and stuff like that, it looks at the individuals of law enforcement and it makes them the heroes of the movie.
I'm about to say it humanizes them.
It humanizes them. And then you look at Hunt for Red October, and it's about a CIA analyst who basically has to, like, drops himself into the Arctic Ocean to be able to board the submarine so that he can, like, you know, help stop nuclear war because they're trying to create this handshake between the Russians and the Americans through Sean Connery's submarine captain turning over this submarine. And so this is like, it's a Tom Clancy. I think it's a Tom Clancy novel. And so, you know, this is Hollywood doing what Hollywood did best, which was...
By the way, I knew the CIA manager that gave them the classified info on real things that happened that's based on... That's Steve Pachinik.
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, it's all of his stuff is based on actual documents and, you know, these scenarios and stuff like that they read. And so, you know, and so their plea was like, look, we're gathering everybody together because this is what we want to do. We want to regain soft power because somewhere along the way, soft power got co-opted and taken control over by this other group. And, you know, I have a very powerful director friend who I'm very close to, who kind of was laughing about it. And he said, I said, there's probably a dinner going on in some other room somewhere else in Los Angeles with another group, and they're trying to do the opposite. And he laughed and he said, oh, you mean like knocking over the apple cart, you know, playfully. And yeah. And so that's when I suddenly realized, oh, my God, there's all these power groups attempting to control narrative. I mean, I always thought movies were just movies.
But oh, that's why I was told when the richest guy in the world at the time, through a whole other meeting about lawsuits like 8 years ago, got me to this thing on this high rise, like Howard Beale Network. And they're in there, and it was off record, so I won't say the names. And they're like, listen, we're actually a good group. We want you to work with us and we'll fix all this. Of course, it was all BS, but it's the same spiel. They're like, we're worried because you keep controlling narratives. We want you to do our narratives. I'm like, no. They said, well, get ready to be sued. And that's what happened.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all about narrative control, and it's all about capturing the audience and then programming them, because people are very simple. And you can, and I think the data was that like a third of the population, and it's probably more now that COVID has happened and fried everybody's pineal gland, calcified it, and everybody's like has limited thinking powers anymore. And it's changed people, but they basically have said now you can control about a third or more now of the audience, because people are just very basic. They're monkey see, monkey do. If you tell them, if you program them to believe, for example, men or women and or a bunch of the DEI stuff, they'll believe it. If you tell them, if you put a non-binary couple, couple on screen, they'll believe it. They'll imitate it. And so you do this enough and people will imitate it. If you put a nuclear family on screen, people will imitate it. People, a certain
amount. And they're giving us stuff that destroys civilization. And that's the thing is, they've broken the social contract to make us more controllable. Like you said, about a third of people are literally robots. We're worried about a robot takeover. We already have it with humans that have become basically robots.
Yeah, yeah. And people will, you know, argue for things that are completely illogical. And it's unreal, actually, how people behave. Have I frozen?
No, you're back. You're great. Listen, this is incredible. Please continue on. We're so blessed to have you. It's amazing, Roger. Roger,
and let's... So I saw this movie recently that really pissed me off called Civil War. It was a movie by this British dude, Alex.
Let's do this, Roger. This is so important. This is so important. Let's reconnect right now. And look, we've got the whole next hour. If you can do it, at least 30 minutes, I want you to we're going to reconnect with you right now. This has been amazing quality until now. It's actually frozen and your audio is starting to go out. So let's reconnect with Roger Avery right now. This is you're getting exclusive top Hollywood writer, you know, top producer, top director, like creme de la creme, is telling you all this as he's waking up to it, and we're all waking up to it. I'm telling what's happened to me, and I told personal story that is embarrassing and true. And it's happened other stuff like that. It's like, it's crazy. And they're watching everything I do, and then it's like, unknown number, hey, we're going to send you a link to this hotel, here it is, go there, boom, it's true. And I'm just like, wow. They're like, yeah, we're your friends. Exactly what they told him. And how do you say no to that? I have, but it's like, it's like God, basically. It's not the equivalent, but like a sub thing. It's like, well, you guys got magic powers. No, they have this surveillance grid, and boy, can it do a lot of stuff for you if you're in the club. You see, and people, a lot of people will go, well, I want to be in this club then. I'm gonna do this right now. I mean, my God. But that's what finally pissed Snowden off, is his CIA handler was watching him and his wife bang and telling him about it. And oh, yeah, your wife's mad at you right now. And it's just like, that's not your right to do that. And now it's come out that, of course, the Meta glasses, whatever AI flags, they have to watch. And so they have contractors in Kenya watching dudes on the toilet have sex with their wife, you know, spanking their kids, whatever. And like, what do you think these things are? It's a Palantir. It's a crystal ball. It's two-way. Whenever Gandalf walks in and Saruman has got a Palantir, he goes, what are you doing? Sauron can see us through this. He goes, why should we be scared to use it? And the point is, there's this godlike power now, and that's what you're talking about. Please continue. But when did you, with Rogan, click to the your analysis of the spell we're under, the mind control, the Satanism.
Well, it was when I started reading the Epstein documents and I started seeing what was inside of them, and it started, I was shocked and I couldn't believe it. And I started telling people, and there, and people don't want to hear it. And so then I went on Rogan and I talked about it, and I talked about, you know, these revelations of that, you know, that elites at a very high level, and we actually know the basic number of them as well, are doing human trafficking, human rape, and human sacrificing of children because they're the closest to God. And when I like read this, I mean, it's unthinkable. Like, you don't want to believe it. And so I mentioned it on Joe Rogan, but I also mentioned that I was starting an AI company. And what shocked me is after the show, more people wanted to talk about the AI thing, and more people were upset about, you know, that I was starting an AI company than they were about, you know, this nightmare of elites eating babies. And so then I started thinking about why is this happening? Well, like, and I mean, we've seen people who have spoken about it, who have, you know, been who have participated in it and who have left. You know, it's a kind of it's an initiation that you go through to become, it's a confidence initiation that you go through to become part of a team. And that's when I realized that this is not something that's unique to the elites, that human nature involves these kinds of hazing initiations, or else we wouldn't see it happening since childhood. Like a bunch of boys get together and kill a squirrel or something. If you're not part of that group, if you're the one kid who's not part of it, and you don't, and you recognize that it's morally wrong, and you separate yourself from that group, you are now outside of that group. If you're in a fraternity and you don't go through the hazing initiation, which, you know, who knows what that is, you are now outside of that group.
If you don't screw the pig or the goat, you're not in the club.
You know, there was a really great movie. In fact, it's my favorite Ridley Scott movie of recent memory. It's the only movie of his that I really, of recent, you know, of his recent films, of his last four or five movies, that I really, really like.
Hold on, stay there. A 2-minute break. Roger Avery. Next hour coming up. Please stay with us.
I'll tell you about it right afterwards.
Yes, sir. Again, amazing interview. You got a top writer, top director here telling you how the cow ate the cabbage. Ed Avery on X, Avery.com. Back in 2 minutes. Everybody, you know, tune in now. This is important. Stay with us.
In a world where globalists, depopulationists, principalities, and powers of the air have been adding, spraying, and inundating humans with heavy metals, chemicals, and toxins, TheAlexJonesStore.com would like to introduce a new way to remove them from your body from the inside out. Introducing Zeolite. Zeolites are a group of crystal-like porous minerals that are found where molten stone meets water. From the Greek zeo, to boil, and lithos, or light, meaning stone, this unique network of tiny little holes and channels found in zeolite absorb and remove harmful substances like heavy metals, chemicals, and other toxins. So don't delay. Start the process of removing unwanted toxins from your body and put some skin in the game of the info war today by going to TheAlexJonesStore.com and picking up a bottle of Zeolite.
Whatever the future may hold, InfoWars will always live forever. The fight will continue. Be sure to follow us on X at RealAlexJones and at AJNLive. And now you can download the number one news app in the world. Go to AlexJonesApp.com and let the Democrat Deep State Party know that we will never be silenced.